accession number 27460, reel 23.
Mr. Wilkes, reel 23. So you were just about to join the unit.
Yes, and this. I had to report to this department where I would leave the camp from. I went in this particular morning after breakfast, and this big burly American with a big felt soft hat on came over to me and he said, "You Bombardier Wilkes?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I'm going to fly you in." So we walked out. There was a little two-seater plane outside. Well, there were a few of them. We were walking out to these and he remarked, he says, "I think it's going to be a bit bumpy up there this morning." And as we were getting into the plane, he said, "It's going to be a bit drafty up there." Now, the windows on the plane were just celluloid, and they just fastened with press studs. And I got in the seat behind him, and he ran the engine up, and we taxied up to one end of this. It had been a paddy field, or two or three paddy fields, run into one. And we taxied, but as we were taxiing up, there was this huge mist descended on the airstrip, and it was rolling towards us. Turned round, we were facing into it, and he's this American sitting there with the engine just ticking over. I would say when it was about 10 or 12 feet away from us, he suddenly just pushed the throttle forward and we roared into it. We couldn't see where the devil we were going, and raced away, and then all of a sudden we were up and we were above it. And we were looking down on this big mist cloud. And we set off. And we were flying along. And he would suddenly just point his thumb out of one side or the other and rock the plane over. And there would be a crashed plane somewhere. We saw a Dakota, a Hurricane and a Spitfire all crashed on the way to where we were going. And eventually we arrived at this clearing, the paddy fields. This airstrip had just been made the night before. And I don't think many of them had landed at this strip previously. At one corner there was a tent, not a very big tent, with a man with an Aldis lamp signalling to the aircraft. Our plane was coming round and my eyes were focused on this tent and the man with the Aldis lamp. We were banking in an acute left-hand turn. We were coming down. And suddenly the plane rocked over the other way and I was just looking at a pair of wheels. And it was another aircraft that had come to land the other way, and he aborted his landing and so did we. And he'd be looking at our wheels the same as we were looking at his. And we veered away, and then our pilot must have signalled to him, to this other pilot, to go in and land. And then we followed suit and went down. And I think it was what we could call a near squeak, but it didn't ruffle my pilot one iota. He was calm, cool and laid back. We touched down and arrived. And we thought there would be someone to welcome us, someone to greet us, someone to tell us what to do. And there wasn't. I was alone, and then one or two other planes landed, and we all, different people, different units, we didn't know what was happening. And then a glider suddenly arrived, and it landed, and it came to a sudden halt in the middle of this paddy field. It had sunk, and they opened the front and took out stretchers, and I think the anti-tank gun came off, and loaded that, and the Dakota was circling all the time that had brought it over, And I'm trying to weigh up how that Dakota could come down, pick up that plane and fly off, and there was no way. Anyway, the man with the oldest lamp said, "Oh, just wait," he said, "you'll see what happens." And we did. The Dakota eventually circled round and dropped the tow line, and that was attached to the glider, and then the line was brought to the side of the airstrip, and it was hung up across two long bamboo poles, and the Dakota circled round, and then this chap told us that he'll make one dummy run and then he'll grab it the next time. And that's exactly what happened. He grabbed it, and I think with it being stuck in the soft ground, the rope was stretching like a piece of elastic, and it was whistling like mad. Then all of a sudden, the glider was airborne, and it looked as though it was going to try and overtake the Dakota. The rope went slack, the glider began to go down, but then the rope tightened, and it was away on its journey home. So we started to make inquiries. "Oh, there'll be no one coming to pick you up. You've got to make your own way from here." "Well, which way?" "Well, that way." So there were about three or four of us by now. We were carrying our kit and we set off. Well, as soon as we got away from the paddy, we were into soft going. It was the mud was coming over the tops of our boots.
This would be about the rainy season, was it?
It was at the end, yes. And we're plodging through this. And I said to these others, I said, "If we can find an abandoned vehicle, we'll try and get it going." Well, we did. And I went to, it was a Japanese lorry, and it was only rear-wheel drive, and I thought, well... But then when I looked inside, there were two skeletons sitting there, so we didn't bother. And we pushed on a bit further and a bit further. And then eventually we heard the sound of a lorry coming along in our direction. And lo and behold, it was our own quartermaster coming along with the ration wagon. And it was a four-wheel drive Chevrolet. And it was grinding along in first and second gear through this mud. And, of course, he saw me. And he said, "Well, sorry, lads." He says, "I can't pick you up. But you can put your kit on the back. And you can hang onto the ropes and walk along the side. It'll help you to pull you along." And that was what we did. We travelled so far. Some of these dropped off so far along because they came to their regiments. And... we came to some of our vehicles that are good tractors that had to be left. They'd broken the drive shafts or torn the spring hangers off the chassis, and they were waiting for parts to come to repair them. So we carried on, and eventually we got to this point, I would say some 20 miles down the Kabul Valley. And we were on a position where the road forked in a Y. And the right-hand fork went down to a place called Kalimio. The left-hand fork went to Kalewa. Now, I know that I've read it, that from Tamu to Kalewa was 105 miles. And it was thick jungle, and it was hard going. And it was at this point we saw quite a few things occur. In the first instance, we had an American ambulance crew that were there. And one of these characters, he was an old man who was there through having laid a bet while he was in America, that he would be able to go to the Far East and fight. But, of course, he was an ambulance driver. There were two of them. But he worked at one of the studios. I think it was the Universal Studios. He knew all the actors and actresses. And so he could tell us quite a lot of told us interesting stories. Anyway, he was there with his ambulance, but it wasn't a four-wheel drive, and it did cause problems later on when we had to move. There was also a meteorological RAF unit with us. This was to get the wind direction for when the guns were firing. Our gun crews had to cut fire lanes for the shells to leave the guns to go to their respective targets. So that was...
It's presumably take the trees out that were in front.
Well, cut branches off so that the shells could go through. That was that. But it was just semi-light, apart from right on the crossroads where the daylight did break through. Now, some of our guns were down the road, down the Kalemio Road, but facing more towards Kalewa. In the corner contained in the Y, there was some East African troops, and from them going down the Kalemio Road, there was an area of tall elephant grass. We were allowed to go down this road so far to a river or stream where we could wash our clothes and things and get a bath. So that was one thing. Now, along to our left of this was situated a Royal Artillery sound-ranging unit, well, an Indian Artillery sound-ranging unit. They were good fighters, sensible men, and they joined the left side of our headquarters position. On the right hand of the headquarters position was a well, which we kind of thought the Japanese might try and use during the night, so we kept it well covered. I can't get the next series of incidents in the correct order, but it went something like this. One morning there was a shot rang out, and we were supposed to be there unnoticed, unaccounted for, and not known to be there. There was a shot rang out, and the RSM came and ticked us all off, wanted to inspect every weapon. And none of them had been fired. And he'd ordered the battery that was the guns for them to check all theirs. No one had fired a rifle. Well, a rifle had been fired. Well, we found the answer to that at evening. Apparently, one of these East Africans had been cutting a way through this long elephant grass to make his way down to the stream to do some washing, and he'd been sniped. And the sniper was right above one of our own guns. And this African had dropped as though killed, and he oriented himself till he could work out where the shot had come from, which direction and everything. And he managed to focus his eyes on the area, and then he finally had spotted the Jap. Now, this story came to us from the white sergeants, the English sergeants that accompanied these East Africans. Well, we were queuing up for our evening meal when this East African came up past our position carrying a Japanese head by the hair. Blood dripping, he'd beheaded him with his machete. So it really whetted our appetite for our evening meal.
had they thought that you may not be rejoining them? You'd been away a long time. Did they know you were coming back, or did you just surprise them by arriving?
I think signals and one thing and another would keep them informed. And by I had a big load of mail to work through. That was interesting.
So there was a, you know, in a sense, there was a line of communication with people on leave who ran into problems or whatever.
Yes. So.
Had anything happened? Had you lost any of your old friends, comrades in the time that you'd been away?
No, we were still okay. We'd had a lot of sickness and illness and things like that. But funny enough, my transport was all going quite well and no serious problems, things that I was able to quickly solve.
When you mentioned sickness there, did you have problems with men, officers, men going sick?
Oh, yes. Dysentery was the main one, malaria slightly. I think that was about it. I think dysentery was the main culprit.
Yes, there was more people suffered from sickness than probably from actual battle wounds.
Yes. So, we were there, and there was a Japanese gun causing us an awful lot of trouble. And we'd fired, we hadn't knocked it out. And these sound ranging unit, they had located that it was being fired from a building, a sort of a shed. But they weren't keeping the gun in there. It was being taken away after it had fired, so that, or it was being brought out to fire. There was something like that. Anyway, these sound rangers, one of these sound rangers was up a tree when the actual branch he was on was shot off by the enemy shell, and he dropped onto the bottom. And for all that, their nerves seemed to stand up pretty well. But then we began to get infiltrated at night, and this was pretty alarming. And I know they attacked this sound ranging unit one night, and it was quite a fireball. The following morning, I think, if my memory serves me right, there were 18 dead Japs lying in the road for the cost of 1,400 rounds of ammunition. If it wasn't that way round, it was 18 rounds of ammunition, 1,800 rounds of ammunition and 14 dead Japs. But that was the way it was that night.
They must have been then quite close to you.
Oh, yes. Infiltration was what they used to...
So your guns must have been pretty well near the actual infantry front line.
That's right, yes. We were.
What kind of distance would be involved, do you think?
Oh, I would think 1,000, 1,500 yards quite often.
And there's still a lot of fight left in the Japanese at this point in time.
Oh, an awful lot. So the next night they came back, and there was a lot more rounds fired, but there was only 4 dead Japs to show for it. So it was then decided that these sound rangers, their nerves had probably gone a bit by now, and they would bring them in to the position to our right, where the water hole was. And they thought, well, they should be all right there. They'll be guarded on the far side by another unit, us on the one side. The thick jungle was behind. There was no one could get through that. So there was only the road. So they were brought in there. So night time came, and weather... They were a bit apprehensive, a bit nervous, or what it was, I don't know. But suddenly, we were all aroused from our beds. We leapt out of our beds with a terrible screaming. We thought they were coming in with the bayonets. And were up and stood to, and shrieks, appalling shrieks. And then it sort of, as it died down, God on earth, what's happened? Anyway, we had to wait until next morning to find out. But what had actually happened was that the sentry that was on duty thought he would just go and through the communication trench and wake his relief up, and his relief was already awake and came to meet him in the communication trench. They each got such a shock they hung on to each other screaming wildly. They were just yards from us, and that's all.
So it wasn't Japanese after all?
No, it wasn't. So now that was that bit. Leading up to this point, we'd been trying to make a complete ring of defence posts round our position so that there was a trench to cross whichever way you came in, apart from the one and only access. So one night the Sergeant Major had wanted to give some details to a driver who was in the next trench to me. Now then, we all used to keep a tin in the bottom of our trench in case anyone needed to urinate during the night. And that tin was kept there for that purpose. But we also used to hang tins on the barbed wire around our positions with a pebble in, so that if the Japs were trying to get by, it would rattle the tin and the pebble and give us a little bit of warning. So this night, the RSM went to the next trench to ours, and he must have set the spoil rolling down into the trench, and it was hitting the tin in the bottom. Of course, everyone was up to alert. We were stood to for a solid hour. We stood down, nothing had occurred, and just as we were standing down, there was a shot rang out. So we all stood to again. And it was the colonel's batman who didn't have his safety catch on his Tommy gun, and he'd shot himself through the welt of his boot, bruising his foot, but that was all. So anyway, all this, you know, we all stood to again. Now, one of these RAF men that was with us, he was making his way back to their caravan, because they didn't used to sleep in the trench, they used to sleep in their caravan, and one of his mates hit him with a machete and nearly scalped him. So that was another night of excitement.
Must have played on your nerves, all this activity.
It did. It tired you. It tired you out.
Was it, in a way, understandable that these kind of mistakes would be made? I mean,
yes.
You couldn't.
There was nothing you could do to prevent them. There's a spoil rattling down into the trench. No, but. And then, this morning, there was the Dakotas were dropping supplies, and the supply drop was just down the Kalimio Road, and they were circling round and circling round, and then without any warning in came 12 zeros, and in less time than it takes me to tell, they'd shot down 3 Dakotas, and they just ploughed down into the trees. It was awful to hear the planes crashing through the trees going down. So it just happened we had a light anti-aircraft regiment beside us as well, and they all had their guns dismantled on maintenance. We'd never seen any aircraft for God knows how long. So mind, the gun next to us was getting reassembled, and the next one over, it was assembled. And then I was standing up on the top to see what was happening, when someone shouted to me, he says, "Look out, bombs." And I looked up, and one of these Zeros came over, and I could see the face of the Japanese pilot. He was flying so low, and he had a big box, of anti-personnel bombs, like very large fountain pens, and he just tipped them out. And fortunately, the ground was soft around where I was standing, and none of them went off. But some hit the anti-aircraft gun near to us, and the next we knew they were shouting for stretcher bearers. And anyway, the AK-AK gun that had been reassembled, he shot the tail cleaner clean off this particular plane, so he went down. So the score was 3-3.
And an exciting moment.
Yes. In the afternoon, the Zeros came back. We'd had Spitfires circling around and no sign of the Zeros. Came the Dakotas and back came the Zeros. And down went another two Dakotas. And I think it was two or else three Zeros again.
And were you being supplied by air at this moment in time?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now then, there again, that was something that I'd like to mention, because the going was so bad through the jungle, and we couldn't supply drop our ammunition. Each shell weighed 100 pounds, so they were too dangerous to drop by air. They couldn't drop them without being crated or something like that, which was impossible. So shells were being transported by mules, one shell per mule per night, and the shells were rationed to five shells per day, non-accumulative. So that was it, and the poor mules used to look exhausted by they got there. We were 20 miles or so into the jungle then, and they had all that. Sometimes when we got further along, they had even further to travel. They used to do it in two stages.
You mentioned trenches there. Were those slit trenches rather than the
yes.
long First World War type trenches?
Slit trenches, yes.
And how deep would they be?
Well, deep enough so that you could fire your weapon over the top. I know someone after the air attack, he would dig even deeper so that he was safer, but... And then he found he needed a petrol tin to stand on if he needed to fire over.
How many people would occupy one slit trench?
At that particular time, I think I had eight on my post.
So they were quite a substantial little trench, you might say.
Yes, yeah. When you were all in it. But sometimes there were just four or six. And the hours of darkness used to be split up so that we divided the time equally.
Between awake and asleep?
Yes. Yeah.
Were you sleeping in at this time?
We dug an area down about 18 inches or so into the ground, and we made ourselves beds out of bamboo poles stuck in the ground, and other bamboo poles fastened onto them and tied our ground sheets around them, something to get us off the ground.
Did you suffer from rats or vermin of any kind?
I don't think so. We had a lot of scorpions, and there were lots of snakes, scorpions, any undesirables, and ants and things like that down there.
So it weren't the most comfortable of situations, presumably.
No, nothing like it, no.
And I know you mentioned going to the river to keep clean, but and washing your clothing and so forth, were you able to do that as a regular basis, or were you getting dirty or tatty?
No, we managed to do it every day, to go and wash something. You didn't have too much to wash. You weren't away from your post very long, but too many of you couldn't leave at once.